Good morning and welcome to Grand Rounds. It's my pleasure to introduce to you Dr. David Forcione. Dr. Forcione joined the Boca Regional staff in January 2019 and serves as the Medical Director of Advanced Therapeutic Endoscopy. He was born and raised in Boston and is summa cum laude graduate of BU and the seven-year bachelor's MD program. He completed his internship and residency in medicine and fellowship in GI at Mass General and completed a fellowship in advanced endoscopy through Mass General and Brigham and Women's Hospital in 2004. He was a faculty member and associate director of interventional endoscopy at Massachusetts General from 2004 to 2018. He was an assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and has lectured on various endoscopy topics at national and international meetings. He has over 50 peer-reviewed publications. Since coming here, just some personal experience as a gastroenterologist, he's just been an excellent resource in terms of referring very complicated pancreatic and biliary cases and cases that required endoscopic ultrasound and drainage, and we're very, very lucky to have Dr. Forcione join Dr. Steinberg here. Without further ado, let me have Dr. Forcione deliver his lecture. Our topic this morning is evaluation and management of biliary obstruction.
Great. Thank you very much, Ken, for the invitation. Can everybody hear me okay? Great. So I was asked to speak on biliary obstruction this morning, and we'll try to take it from sort of beginning to end, diagnostic evaluation through management, and hopefully give you some examples of how we can manage these patients collaboratively as a group between radiology, surgery, and gastroenterology. So I just want to let you know of no financial disclosures or conflicts of interest. And we're going to start by reviewing bilirubin metabolism. It's kind of a bit of a dry topic, but it's very important to understand biliary obstruction by understanding biliary metabolism. And that way we can understand the differential diagnosis of the jaundiced patient. Talk about how the pathophysiology of biliary obstruction can help us understand what is causing it, the clinical presentations, and review the diagnostic evaluation and management strategies. So as a baseline, bilirubin comes from heme. Heme is the precursor molecule for bilirubin metabolism, and as we all know, heme is the iron-containing compound found within largely hemoglobin, but other important compounds, myoglobin, cytochromes, peroxidases, that are all found throughout the body, of course, hemoglobin being the dominant compound. So how does heme become bilirubin? So the majority of this does come from hemoglobin. About 80% of heme is derived from hemoglobin. The remainder comes from other heme-containing proteins like myoglobin and senescent cells in the bone marrow. About 400 milligrams per day on average are produced for metabolism into bilirubin. It's not critical to understand the various biochemical pathways, just to know that there are two main precursors to bilirubin, heme being the first, followed by biliverdin. And in this reaction, it's one of, I think it's the only one in the body where carbon monoxide is actually formed in the body. Once biliverdin is produced, biliverdin is then converted to bilirubin. And this process takes place largely in the spleen, mostly as old red blood cells are trafficked through the spleen or broken down by macrophages. It also can occur in the liver and bone marrow. So this conglomerate of bilirubin is then bound to albumin, and this combination of albumin and bilirubin allows it to be soluble in the blood, carried then as a combined molecule to the liver, where it will be metabolized further and then excreted. So this is a very important pathway for bilirubin production. Now, to understand it a little bit more simply, one can think of it in the form of something we can see often day to day, and that's in the form of a bruise. So on day zero, if you have a bruise, you get a expatriation of blood cells out of capillaries into the subcutaneous tissue. You can see the red blush. Typically within a couple of days, it'll turn purple, and that's because the red blood cells become deoxygenated. And then typically by day seven, you'll start seeing a greenish-yellow hue to the bruise, and that's the production of biliverdin from the heme that's broken down at the level of the hematoma. And this is carried out by tissue macrophages in the subcutaneous space. Then typically by day 10, it becomes less green and more yellow, and this is a visual example of bilirubin metabolism. If we look at it from the bigger picture, this cartoon really helps to explain how various disorders of bilirubin metabolism can be understood. As we just talked about, the major source of bilirubin production is in the form of hemoglobin, which comes from the senescent red blood cells that are trafficked through the spleen, broken down by macrophages, and released converted to bilirubin from heme, biliverdin, and bilirubin. So the bilirubin is then carried to the liver on albumin, and this is where the major metabolism of bilirubin is carried out. So in the liver, bilirubin-albumin conjugate is carried into the hepatocyte where it undergoes conjugation, and this is a critical step of bilirubin metabolism. If you do not conjugate bilirubin, you cannot excrete it. So the conjugation process of bilirubin is what makes it water-soluble, and it allows it to get into bile. There are some congenital abnormalities that affect the ability of the liver to conjugate bilirubin, the most common being Gilbert syndrome, which is something we all see clinically. It affects about 10 to 20% of the population, and that's related to a deficiency or reduced function of the glucuronidation process in the liver. So if you cannot glucuronidate bilirubin, you have backup of unconjugated bilirubin in the blood, and you get the indirect hyperbilirubinemia. So once the liver is able to conjugate the bilirubin, it's excreted, transported out of the hepatocyte into the biliary tree as a conjugated molecule. That's what makes it soluble into the bile duct. Once it's in the bile duct, it's transported into the GI tract and the small intestine, where bacteria in the GI tract then deconjugate the glucuronic acid moiety from bilirubin, and this is where it's converted to urobilinogen. And urobilinogen is the molecule that ultimately gets into the urinary system to make the urine the typical yellow color. And it's also responsible for the brown color of stool, which is in the form of a compound called stercobilin. So urobilinogen is broken down by bacteria into another compound called stercobilin, and that's what makes the stool brown. So if you can understand this pathway, you can really understand all of the different areas where things can get broken down. As you can imagine, if there's absent glucuronidation, bilirubin cannot get excreted from the liver into the biliary tree. If there's an obstruction of the biliary tree, obviously the conjugated bilirubin cannot be excreted, and you'll have less urobilinogen production or less urobilinogen passage into the stool, less urobilinogen passage into the urine, and that explains why patients who have biliary obstruction have pale-colored stools and have very dark urine. So when we think about disorders of bilirubin metabolism, it's just important to remember that jaundice, of course, is not a disease itself. It's a physical manifestation of hyperbilirubinemia. It does not indicate a specific cause. And in general, this is something that one of my professors had taught me years ago, is that it really does take a bilirubin in general for the average clinician to be about 5. For you to see it visually. For a real master clinician, you can probably see it when it's 2 to 3. Typically, you'll see it in the sclera first because of the white background. You can also obviously see it in the skin as a yellowish discoloration. But in general, when you see jaundice, you can estimate that the bilirubin level is going to be at least 5 if you can see it on physical examination. So from sort of 30,000 feet, if you look at bilirubin metabolism disorders, there are 2 broad categories. There's congenital disorders of bilirubin metabolism, and I won't get into detail on these because these are generally pretty uncommon, with the exception exception of Gilbert syndrome, which all of us in the room have seen, will see. This is, you know, 10 to 20% of the population have a reduced activity of the glucuronidation process in the liver, and that leads to intermittent indirect hyperbilirubinemia, completely, mostly asymptomatic, has no negative prognostic patterns for patients. These are patients who are generally very healthy. So these congenital conditions are really related to disorders of glucuronidation or transport of conjugated bile or bilirubin out of the liver. Again, pretty uncommon. The ones that we see on a day-to-day basis, of course, are in the acquired category. Most of us don't deal with neonates, but we all know that neonatal hyperbilirubinemia is fairly common. About 50% of newborns will have neonatal hyperbilirubinemia, and this is related to reduced hepatocyte glucuronidation. So it's a maturation process. If you're a premature baby, it's about an 80% chance you're going to have neonatal hyperbilirubinemia. Of course, if you have hemolysis, you have an increased influx of heme into the circulation, whether it's trauma-related or immune-mediated or related to sickle cell anemia. Any hemolytic process will increase the heme volume in the circulation. Of course, more heme volume means more conversion from heme to biliverdin to bilirubin. So if you have any hemolysis, increased heme volume, you will have a greater chance of an indirect hyperbilirubinemia. Hepatocellular conditions, of course, is very common. Chronic viral hepatitis, chronic alcoholic liver disease. These are patients who have disorders of hepatocyte metabolism, cannot conjugate bilirubin, cannot excrete bilirubin. So these patients generally have both direct and indirect hyperbilirubinemia. And sort of the topic of the day is more of a bile duct plumbing issue, which is obstruction. And these patients can conjugate normally, can excrete the bilirubin out of the liver cell normally, but they cannot pass bile out of the bile duct due to a mechanical obstruction. And therefore, these patients have a conjugated hyperbilirubinemia presentation. So when you think about biliary obstruction, it's really a flow issue. We're all familiar with the anatomy of the biliary tree as a very complicated branching tree-like structure involving both lobes of the liver with multiple branches extending throughout the liver. And, of course, the flow of bile is in the direction of the distal bile duct into the GI tract. And any point along the way, you can have a flow issue. If you look at the composition of bile, it's interesting to note that of the typical 700 milliliters of bile that we each produce on a daily basis, the vast majority of it is just water, and only a very small percentage of bile is bilirubin, only about 0.2%. The other critical component is bile salts, and this is important because any type of biliary obstruction will have multiple potential clinical consequences. So, of course, the one that we fear the most and we probably recognize the most is bile stasis-related issues. So if you have bile sitting in a bile duct, there is an increased chance of stasis-related infection from typically enteric pathogens just from stasis. But it's important to remember that because of the other components of bile, such as bile salts, you are unable to metabolize digestive fats or ingested fats. So typically this will be in the form of a fat malabsorption, so patients with chronic biliary obstruction can have steatorrhea, can have fat-soluble vitamin deficiency, particularly A, D, E, and K. Chronic hyperbilirubinemia, we often see patients presenting with anorexia, fatigue, and although very unusual and most often described in neonatal hyperbilirubinemia is this concept of kernicterus, which is the deposition of bilirubin into the brain, and that can cause neurologic issues, particularly seizure disorders. We don't see this very commonly in adults. And of course, if you have chronic obstruction, as a consequence, the hepatocytes start getting unhappy if you have chronic flow issues out of the bile duct. So one of the consequences of chronic biliary obstruction is chronic hepatocyte dysfunction or liver failure, so-called secondary sclerosing cholangitis. So when we think about clinical presentations and classifications, most people think of biliary obstruction in sort of two domains. One is location. What is the location or the point of obstruction? Is it intrahepatic or above the common hepatic duct, or is it extrahepatic involving the extrahepatic bile duct? It's important to remember for extrahepatic obstruction, all you need is a single point of obstruction, because this is, of course, the main trunk of drainage. Whereas if you have intrahepatic obstruction, you will not develop hyperbilirubinemia or jaundice if you have just segmental, isolated intrahepatic obstruction. It really is, in general, a diffuse process when you have intrahepatic obstruction. So these are patients with multiple diffuse intrahepatic metastatic disease or have a diffuse bile duct, small bile duct inflammatory conditions such as primary sclerosing cholangitis. More commonly, we think of obstructive jaundice or biliary obstruction in the form of what is the cause? Is it benign or is it malignant? And that's usually how we evaluate these patients in that domain. So if you look at different causes, these are the most common causes that we see on a day-to-day basis when we look at it from the perspective of benign versus malignant. In the benign category, of course, stone disease is by far the most common clinical presentation that we see on a day-to-day basis, and we'll dive into that a little bit more. Pancreatitis, both acute and chronic, can present with biliary obstruction. Really, any intra-abdominal fluid collection that abuts the biliary tree or the pancreas can cause biliary obstruction. Post-operative strictures, so surgical complications from hepatobiliary surgery. Autoimmune diseases, there's now a pretty good understanding of an autoimmune bile duct abnormality called IgG4 cholangiopathy. You can have bleeding into the bile duct, which will essentially mimic what stone obstruction will look like clinically. So intraductal clots, intraductal bleeding can present with biliary obstruction. And then more rare is the radiation-related strictures, primary sclerosing cholangitis, which is a fibroinflammatory condition typically seen in patients with ulcerative colitis, typically young men with ulcerative colitis.
Ulcerative colitis will present
primary sclerosing cholangitis. Parasites and HIV. HIV is really no longer something that we see clinically in the era now of antiretroviral therapy. On the malignant side, pretty much anything that will affect the pancreas, the bile duct itself, gallbladder, duodenum, can present with biliary obstruction. You can also have metastatic disease to the porta hepatis or the liver itself cause biliary obstruction. So we're going to talk a little bit more in detail about these different clinical presentations. So, of course, stone disease is very common. About 15% of patients with gallstones will present with biliary tract stones. And, of course, these patients can have just biliary obstruction by itself in the form of obstructive jaundice, or what we see very commonly is pancreatitis related to impaction of the stone at the distal bile duct causing obstruction of the pancreatic duct. There are generally three common stones that we see. So cholesterol stones are the most common, and we really only see these in patients who have an intact gallbladder, so you really shouldn't form cholesterol stones if your gallbladder has been removed. Pigment stones are probably the second most common. We see these in patients who have chronic liver disease or who have hemolytic conditions, sickle cell anemia or thalassemia. These are a different type of stone. These are typically calcium bilirubinate stones. And then finally, brown stones are more soft stones. These are typically seen in patients who have been previously instrumented and have bacterial colonization of the bile duct. Here's just an ERCP example showing what a column of bile duct stones would look like in somebody who has an intact gallbladder with multiple stones, some of which have passed into the common bile duct. So it's important to recognize that there's a wide range of clinical presentations that we see in patients who have stone-related biliary obstruction. And why patients present differently really depends on how acute the obstruction is, the patient's age, their comorbidities. And we do see patients who are completely asymptomatic. They're just found to have mildly abnormal liver tests, sent for imaging, and they're found to have 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 stones in their bile duct. I would say typically these are patients who are elderly, tend to have more chronically dilated bile ducts, and may not present in the typical manifestations of pain or fever. Of course, more commonly, we see patients in this category, which is presenting with right upper quadrant pain, abnormal LFTs, and then as we go to the right on this slide, sort of less common clinical presentations are listed here, Charcot's triad and Raynaud's pentad. Charcot's triad is the one that I would say we see more commonly, of course, in the inpatient setting, patients coming in with right upper quadrant pain, fever, and jaundice. In theory, we should be seeing very few of these patients. Those are the ones that have the triad, but also develop hypotension and delirium. Those are patients that really are less and less common because we are more accurate and recognize the diagnosis earlier. So if you see a patient who is hypotensive and has altered mental status, you've probably, there's been a delay in the diagnosis and those patients have been inadequately resuscitated or started on antibiotics. So this is really what we're trying to prevent with early institution of volume expansion, antibiotics, and decompression is the progression to the more severe state. One variant that comes up a couple of times per year is Maritzi syndrome, which you may have heard of. This is when you have biliary tract obstruction related to typically an impacted stone in the neck of the gallbladder or the cystic duct. This is a kind of a unique clinical presentation in the sense of imaging can be very confusing in these patients. They're often confused to have a biliary tract malignancy because of the severity of the edema and the inflammatory changes that happen in the bile duct. So oftentimes these patients are mistaken for having a biliary tract malignancy rather than stone disease, and it takes a good amount of detective work in the form of imaging and endoscopic evaluation to convince yourself that this is indeed the problem. Of course, this is managed with cholecystectomy and oftentimes endoscopic stenting until the swelling goes down. But this is something that you will see on occasion. Now, in regards to pancreatitis, both acute and chronic pancreatitis can cause biliary obstruction. In the acute setting, we see this in the form of pancreatic head edema. Any type of pancreatitis, whether it's alcohol or stone-related, typically will cause swelling of the head of the pancreas. That swelling will cause compression of the bile duct, which, as we know, anatomically traverses the head of the pancreas. This is usually transient. Once the swelling goes down, the biliary obstruction goes away, so it rarely requires any type of drainage procedure and usually just settles with supportive therapy. On the flip side, patients who have either recurrent acute pancreatitis or a true chronic pancreatitis with structural abnormalities of the pancreas, typically alcohol-related and tobacco-related, will develop real narrowing of the bile duct or strictures of the bile duct related to pancreatic fibrosis. And usually these patients present sort of more subacutely, weeks to months, abnormal liver tests, rarely with cholangitis, but on imaging and lab-wise will have typical findings of biliary obstruction. And these patients are managed typically with surgical therapy for their chronic pancreatitis or endoscopic therapy. Now, postoperative sources of biliary obstruction certainly can be seen. This can happen with any type of hepatobiliary surgery. Of course, the most common in the U.S. being cholecystectomy. The frequency of this, of course, is extremely rare, but it can happen both with cholecystectomy, and I've seen it more often with liver transplant. Here's just an example of a post-cholecystectomy bile duct stricture. You can see all of these surgical clips near the expected takeoff of the cystic duct, and you have this long, kind of smooth-looking stricture of the bile duct with dilation of the bile duct above it. Typically, this is related to ischemic injury to the bile duct next to where the clips are placed. It's a vascular phenomenon, and less commonly, there's a direct injury to the duct from surgical manipulation. These patients don't present acutely. Typically, they present weeks to months after their surgery, and you know, unless you know what their surgical history is, you might miss the diagnosis. This is usually very amenable to endoscopic management with dilation and stent therapy. Something that's fairly new and still being increasingly recognized and made aware of is what's called IgG4 cholangiopathy. We're more familiar with it in the setting of pancreatitis, autoimmune pancreatitis. This is the biliary manifestation of autoimmune pancreatitis. And essentially, this is a condition of multifocal bile duct strictures. This is an MRCP showing multiple strictures and narrowings of the bile duct. Typically, these patients have elevated serum IgG4 levels. The higher the IgG4 level, the greater the specificity. More than two times the upper limit of normal is what we're looking for. Many of these patients will have other organ involvement, pancreas, salivary glands. It's unusual just to have biliary tract involvement. So when you consider this diagnosis, you look for other organs that also have IgG4 plasma cell infiltration. The challenge with this diagnosis is that many of these patients are elderly. For all the world, you show this to 100 radiologists, they're going to call, 99 of them will call this cholangiocarcinoma, and you just have to have a very high clinical suspicion, consider the diagnosis. And our practice when I was in Boston is before anybody had hepatobiliary resection, unless there was a definitive diagnosis, everybody had an IgG4 level to be sure that we weren't operating on patients that had a medically treatable condition. So it's just something to think about in patients that you're considering cholangiocarcinoma but don't have a tissue diagnosis. And the importance of this is it's very steroid responsive, so you can basically make this go away very quickly with corticosteroids. Something that is uncommon, but something that we should think about in patients who have had abdominal trauma, who have had recent abdominal surgery. And I would say the most common scenario I've seen this in is patients that who've undergone liver biopsy can develop hemobilia. And these are patients that will present just like they have a stone. They'll have acute onset of pain. Their LFTs will be elevated. They may be jaundiced. And the only tip-off is that they're also manifesting acute blood loss by lab work. And endoscopically, they're going to look like this with basically this is the major ampulla, and you have a clot sticking out of the orifice, and obviously bile can't get around this. And really, for all the world, this will manifest as a clinically as a stone. The important thing is knowing the history of that patient. It's managed the same way as a stone as far as endoscopic decompression. Now, this is something that probably most of us will see once or twice in their lifetime, which is biliary parasites. There are four parasites that can manifest as biliary obstruction. The most common worldwide is Ascaris. This is a long roundworm that likes to live in the bile duct and pancreatic duct. This is seen in typically Southeast Asia. Fasciola is another one, typically in South America. This is found in freshwaters, Echinococcus, and Clonorchis. I've seen two of these in practice, and the clinical history is always the same. Patients being transferred from the airport where they presented with signs of biliary obstruction. This is a video showing one such case. So this is an ERCP with a balloon catheter pulling out from the bile duct. And you never know what you're going to get, but this is definitely not a stone. This is alive and kicking. So the important thing with this, and of course we're not going to see many of these cases, is that you should not try to break up the parasite within the bile duct, because it will reproduce. You'll break it down so that the eggs will be released. So you have to try to remove the parasite intact from the bile duct and extract it intact from the body optimally, but you don't want to break it in half like a stone or fragment it in the bile duct, because that will just lead to more problems. Now, getting away from benign obstruction to malignant obstruction, this is a very different clinical presentation in regards to how these patients present. It's typically much more subacute. They often will have really minimal to no pain. These are the so-called painless jaundice patients. These are the ones you worry about when they come in bright yellow and you ask them if they have pain. They really say no, not much, and that's when you start getting worried that this is malignancy. They'll often have concomitant weight loss, and they'll often have pruritus. The pruritus has nothing to do with the bilirubin itself. These are retained bile salts. Remember, bile also has bile salts in it, so when you have bile duct obstruction, you're going to also back up bile salts. It's never been clear to me. Some patients will have bilirubins 30 to 40 and will have no itching whatsoever. Other patients will have a bilirubin of 7 and they'll be itching out of their mind, the worst type of itch they can imagine. I still don't quite understand that one, but if you see pruritus, it's typically related to a malignant bile duct obstruction. Now, the pattern of malignant obstruction really can be quite varied. Of course, we see a lot of diffuse metastatic disease in the liver from colorectal metastases, ovarian, breast, lung, et cetera, any parenchymal metastatic disease of the liver. The important thing, it has to be a significant volume. You have to basically take out a majority of the liver for somebody to become jaundiced, for you to have intrahepatic metastatic disease as a cause of biliary obstruction and jaundice. More typically, of course, pancreatic cancer, pancreatic head malignancy, ductal adenocarcinoma will obstruct the extrahepatic bile duct. You can have an ampullary malignancy obstructing the distal bile duct, gallbladder cancer, bile duct cancer itself, cholangiocarcinoma, and then something we see sort of more commonly, I would say, in ovarian patients with ovarian cancer or breast cancer is periportal adenopathy. So adenopathy basically compressing on the outside of the bile duct causing obstruction. So any one of these sites can be a source of malignant biliary obstruction. So of course there are visible indicators of malignant biliary obstruction. The scleral icterus that we talked about earlier. Patients will readily tell you about their pruritus because that's usually the thing that's bothering the most. And if you examine them, they'll have excoriations all over the body. Typically, it's worse at night. When they describe this to you, you should always ask about their urine color and their stool color. So patients with malignant biliary obstruction typically have very dark urine because of backup of bilirubin and excretion into the urine. And the other thing patients will potentially describe to you, but best if you ask them, is the color of their stool. So if they tell you that they have lighter colored stool or what's called acolic stools or clay colored stools, this is a sign of obstruction. Remember, urobilinogen, if it does not get out of the bile duct, it cannot be converted to stercobilin, and that's the chemical that makes stool the normal color. So the absence of stercobilin in the setting of biliary obstruction leads to a changed appearance of the stool. So, of course, everything starts with a good history and physical examination. Trying to get a sense of the timeline, is it acute onset of jaundice versus subacute? Somebody that was fine yesterday and today is jaundiced, typically that's a benign etiology, an obstructive stone type of pattern. If it's been going on for days to weeks, it's more concerning for a malignant obstruction. Associated symptoms, important to know about weight loss, pain, fever, surgical history, medications, travel because of the parasites, and of course family history of malignancy. And on exam, of course, you want to look for signs of sepsis, tachycardia, hypotension, fever, cachexia, excoriations. Can you palpate an abdominal mass? Can you palpate their gallbladder? Courvoisier sign is a physical exam manifestation of gallbladder distension. It does not indicate a specific cause, but typically when you have a palpable gallbladder, it's usually a malignant biliary obstruction situation. Labs are not always helpful. This is just a chart kind of outlining different lab patterns between a hemolytic-based hyperbilirubinemia, one that's based in hepatocellular disease, and one that's purely an obstructive pattern. You can see there's a fair amount of overlap. Of course, there are some that are particularly helpful. So the red indicates that these are very abnormal. The green means they're normal, and yellow is they're borderline elevated. So in patients with hemolysis, it's typically an indirect hyperbilirubinemia. Their direct bilirubin levels are normal, and these patients will have low haptoglobin levels and an elevated reticulocyte count. In contrast, the obstructed patients will have normal haptoglobin reticulocyte count and indirect bilirubin, and these patients will have typically ALK-FOS elevations and conjugated hyperbilirubinemia. One thing that's important, and I think we've all seen this a few times, is that the lab abnormalities that we usually think of in patients with obstruction, ALK-FOS elevation, bilirubin elevation, is not always going to be found. If you're lucky enough, so to speak, to catch somebody in the sort of hyperacute timeline, which means they're literally showing up as their bile duct is being obstructed, and I say this because this has been sort of borne out in animal models of biliary obstruction. When you tie off a dog's bile duct, the first thing to go up is an AST and an ALT elevation, and the alkaline phosphatase and bilirubin are delayed. So occasionally you may be fooled by the LFT presentation of AST and ALT being the first things to be elevated. So still think about biliary obstruction if it's just an AST-ALT rise in the setting, of course, pain in those patients. Also remember that alkaline phosphatase is an inducible enzyme, meaning it typically does not start rising for 2 to 3 days after obstruction develops. So you may not see this in the hyperacute phase. Ancillary labs, of course, lipase is useful if you're thinking about pancreatitis, IgG4 level. IgG4 level is an insensitive test. Only about 40 to 50% of patients who have autoimmune cholangiopathy will have a positive IgG4 level. When it's greater than 3 times upper limit of normal, the specificity is very good. So if you have a level that's that high, there are very few things that can be diagnosed in that setting. About 10% of patients with pancreatic cancer will have an IgG4 elevation, so be careful when you're trying to interpret IgG4 levels that are sort of 1.5 times, less than 2 times upper limit of normal. It can still be pancreatic cancer. It's not diagnostic unless it's really above 3 times upper limit of normal. One thing about CA19-9, remember that CA19-9 is a tumor marker that is not ubiquitous in pancreatobiliary cancer patients. About 10% of patients will have a normal CA19-9 level, so it does not rule out or rule in the diagnosis of pancreatobiliary malignancy. And it's very important to remember that any kind of biliary obstruction, whether it's stones, parasites, what have you, can elevate the CA19-9 level. So if we just randomly measure CA19-9 levels in patients that come in jaundice, we're going to mistakenly assume that some patients have cancer when it's not. And I've seen CA19-9 levels over 1,000 in patients that do not have cancer, and it's just an acute elevation in the setting of obstruction. So the sort of the important thing is to not use this as a screening test, to use it in the setting of patients who have a diagnosed malignancy to follow their course, not in the setting of acute jaundice. So imaging, of course, is essential in all these patients. Question number one being, is there obstruction? Of course, that's the main issue. And biliary obstruction, is there evidence of dilation of the bile ducts, yes or no? In general, we say 6 millimeters or more of the common bile duct is dilated if the gallbladder is intact. If the gallbladder has been surgically removed, sort of the rules about gallbladder bile duct diameter kind of fall out the window a little bit. There really aren't defined rules. It's a matter of what the change is over time. If patients have had prior imaging since their gallbladder has been removed, there's been an acute change. But in general, patients that have an intact gallbladder, if it's over 6, we consider that abnormal. Imaging can also tell us what the level of the obstruction is. Is it intrahepatic or is it extrahepatic? It can give us information about benign versus malignant, and importantly, it can tell us, because of the level of obstruction, is this something that can be fixed endoscopically by radiology or by surgery? So there's a lot of different choices for imaging. Ultrasound, of course, CT, MRI, MRCP. And I put HydaScan in there, but I do want to say that I don't think HydaScan, at least in my opinion, really, I don't think has a significant role for biliary obstruction evaluation. I think HydaScans are very good for, you know, evaluating patients for biliary leaks, postoperative biliary leaks, but I think there are, you know, major issues with false positives and false negatives when you're looking at it from the perspective of obstruction. So I would tend to avoid that imaging study when you're considering patients for obstruction. Tier two is when we think about more, of course, invasive options for imaging and treatment, ERCP and EUS. When we consider the variables as far as which imaging study we should choose from, there's a lot of different factors. All of the imaging studies, ultrasound, CT, MR, MRCP, are very good for saying ducts dilated, yes or no. They're all, I think, equally good for that question. If your specific question is there a stone in the bile duct causing the obstruction, it's important to remember that transabdominal ultrasound is not very sensitive. Okay, only about 30 to 35% of stones will be picked up on transabdominal ultrasound. That's because of overlying bile gas. Patient body habitus may preclude good imaging of the bile duct. That sense that detection rate goes up to about 60% with CT and then goes up to 90% with MRI. As far as imaging of pancreatic biliary masses, of course, ultrasound is inferior to CT and MR. Radiation, of course, ultrasound and MR have no radiation. Contrast is required optimally for CT and MR, not for ultrasound or MRCP. And of course, MR is the most costly of the modalities. You know, from my perspective as a consultant in these cases, I think ultrasound is helpful if the patient has an intact gallbladder and you're working them up for biliary tract stones. If the gallbladder is known to be surgically absent, I personally don't see a big role for using ultrasound in sort of upfront imaging of these patients. Similarly, CAT scan, I don't think there's a huge advantage or really any advantage to doing a non-contrast CT scan in patients with suspected biliary tract obstruction. You're not going to be able to see the anatomy well enough to discern level of obstruction, mass, yes or no, so I wouldn't bother getting a non-contrast CT scan in these patients. MRI is very effective, but of course is sort of hindered by situations such as pacemakers, defibrillators. There's also potential issue of respiratory artifacts of patients that have respiratory conditions that have, you know, sleep apnea, difficulty maintaining stable respiratory patterns will have a lot of respiratory artifact on their imaging studies. So you have to sort of consider that when you're trying to decide which imaging modality you're going to choose from. You know, at the end of the day, these are all complementary studies, but you know, what I would say is it's really best to take an individualized approach. I think what I often see is patients are getting all of these studies done sort of simultaneously, you know, within 24 hours, and I don't think that that's you know, good use of imaging, good use of resources, and I think it's really best to individualize the approach based on what is your clinical suspicion as to what's going on. What is, you feel strongly that this is stone disease, you think this is malignancy, what is their renal function as far as giving them contrast, and really what is the added value. If you already have a study such as a CT or an MR that shows obstruction, do you really need an ultrasound at that point? So I would just, you know, think about it as an individualized approach as to which imaging modality you're going to get. I would avoid getting all studies in all patients because it's redundant, it's cost ineffective, and I've personally seen several cases in my practice where patients have literally had ultrasound, CT, and MR within 24 hours, and you get differing results. You know, one study will say bile duct is X millimeters, to literally study within 24 hours say the bile duct is another size. So it can often give you clinically confusing results, and it makes it more difficult to manage the patients. So from an endoscopic perspective, of course, there's added utility once you've done your cross-sectional imaging to sort of pinpoint this further. Modalities that we have at our disposal are ERCP and endoscopic ultrasound. These both provide diagnostic roles and therapeutic roles, both from an imaging perspective, you know, getting a cholangiogram doing biopsies within the bile duct, and of course is the premier treatment for drainage of the bile duct. We now have readily access to endoscopic ultrasound, which gives us the ability to do transluminal biopsies through the stomach, through the duodenum, to biopsy pretty much any intra-abdominal organ, pancreas, lymph nodes, bile ducts, liver. And we now have the ability to use endoscopic ultrasound to perform ductal drainage in cases where ERCP is either ineffective or inaccessible because of prior surgery. We'll move on to management. Of course, the initial management strategy is to do appropriate clinical, laboratory, and diagnostic evaluation. All these patients are generally relatively dehydrated, so IV fluid hydration. Early antibiotics, I think, is critical. Of course, we don't want patients sitting around with biliary obstruction with the potential of developing sepsis, so we have to treat preemptively for enteric gram-negative rods, and enterococcus being the most common. If they've never been instrumented before, these patients probably should be given upfront cephalosporins, third-generation cephalosporins, or fluoroquinolones. If they're patients that have been instrumented, meaning they've had prior ERCPs, they have stents in place, they've had some sort of biliary tract surgery, they're, of course, higher risk for having resistant organisms, and these are the patients that probably should be given upfront extended spectrum penicillin, such as Zosyn, carbapenems, and often vancomycin to treat enterococcus. But I don't think upfront patients that are de novo, come off the street, so to speak, never been instrumented, need these very potent antibiotics and can be readily treated with cephalosporins and fluoroquinolones. So once you have the medical management, you got to call a plumber, and I'm a card-carrying member of this this club at this point. And so we're very familiar with ERCP. This is something that was developed in Japan in the late 1960s. It's really the established primary role for biliary decompression. Really, the only absolute contraindication to doing an ERCP nowadays is patients' inability to undergo anesthesia. Of course, all these patients need to be anesthetized, either with a monitored anesthetic or a general anesthetic. Relative contraindications, uncontrolled coagulopathy, if they have an impassable stricture in their esophagus, the scope can't get through, or on occasion we'll have patients that have really complicated post-operative luminal anatomy, the most feared being gastric bypass, where it's virtually impossible to reach the bile duct using conventional scopes. So I'm just going to show a few videos of how ERCP can be helpful in these patients with biliary tract obstruction, first as a diagnostic tool. So conventional ERCP looks like this. This is a normal cholangiogram. Here's the common bile duct, cystic duct, gallbladder, right hepatic duct, left hepatic duct. This is a normal biliary tree on cholangiogram. We now have the ability with accessory tools to take that a step further and to put a scope within a scope, which is what we call a cholangioscope, passing a mini camera through the ERCP scope into the bile duct, and this is what a normal bile duct looks like from the inside. And this is being used more and more as both a diagnostic and a therapeutic tool to examine the insides of the bile duct for filling defects, soft tissue lesions, and for treatment of large stones. You can see the image quality is rather impressive. So here's an example of what it would look like in a patient who has a suspected malignant stricture. Sorry. So here's the initial cholangiogram showing a narrowing of the bile duct. Here's an inflated balloon injecting contrast, and you see this narrowing of the bile duct. This typically, when we see this, is a bile duct cancer, but often these patients have negative biopsies when we do brushings or scrapings of the bile duct. These are often very desmoplastic tumors, and our brushing yield or cytologic yield can be very low. So we often will go to cholangioscopy to evaluate these patients. This is what it will look like. We often will dilate with a balloon where it's narrowed to help pass the miniscope or the cholangioscope up the bile duct. And this is what the cholangioscope looks like. We pass this through our ERCP scope into the bile duct and get direct visualization inside of the bile duct. This is normal bile duct lining, completely normal glistening mucosa. And then as we pull back into the area where it's narrowed, we get a very nice view of this very abnormal mucosa. And it gives us the ability to do targeted biopsies of the area under direct visualization. This is a very typical-looking malignant stricture because you see these very engorged tumor vessels within the stricture. Not pathognomonic, but this is very typical. And the beauty of the procedure is that we really can get very targeted biopsies and give more tissue to the pathologist for pathologic evaluation. You see these little tumor vessels here. And with enough tissue, we can get confirmatory biopsies. Here's another patient that I saw a couple years ago, that a young woman who presented with biliary obstruction, and she had imaging. And for all the world, everybody thought she had a bile duct stone because she had this very round filling defect in her bile duct, and she'd been seen at another hospital. They couldn't remove the stone, and the reason why the stone couldn't be removed because it's not a stone. It's a very round tumor in the bile duct, and without cholangioscopy, it would have been very difficult to identify this as a round soft tissue mass. Of course, we will use ERCP very commonly as a therapeutic tool. These are just some examples of how we can remove stones from the bile duct. These are slightly sped up. We don't actually move that fast when we're doing these. So here's a rather large stone on this side here. A smaller one over here. The punchline here. So once we've made an opening in the bile duct with the sphincterotomy, it's much easier to remove the stone. Typically, we'll use an inflated balloon above the stone, and then just pull through. They all don't come out that easily, unfortunately. So another role for cholangioscopy is in utilization as a therapeutic tool. This is an example of a patient that had basically a bile duct full of stones, and instead of spending a lot of time removing each stone, we can use the cholangioscope to do directed lithotripsy or laser lithotripsy right inside the bile duct. This is similar technology to what urologists have used over the years to fragment urinary tract stones, and it makes for a much more expedient treatment to remove the stones. Now, as far as moving away from stone disease, if you have a malignant obstruction, of course, you need to palliate that or treat that with some sort of stent. And when we think about stenting, the goal is to optimize the drainage of the extrahepatic bile duct in at least 25% of the liver. One of the things that we've learned over the years from biliary drainage procedures is that you do not have to drain the entire liver to fix somebody's jaundice. Typically, all you need to drain is about 25% to resolve their bilirubin. Now, that doesn't mean the rest of their LFTs will be normal, but if your goal is to get their bilirubin within normal range, about 25% of drainage is what's needed. We have two types of stents, plastic stents, which are smaller diameter, shown here, up to about 3.3 millimeters. These are removable, of course, and these are mostly used, in my practice at least, for intrahepatic obstruction, where patients may have multiple complicated strictures above the bifurcation involving the intrahepatic ducts, and where metal stents, these much bigger metal stents, may be prohibitive in placement there. Metal stents are much bigger. These are either removable or non-removable. There are two different kinds. These are largely used for extrahepatic obstruction, where you have typically a simple stricture of the bile duct, usually from pancreatic cancer. So here's what one looks like when placed. So this is a malignant distal bile duct stricture. Here's a metal stent being deployed under fluoroscopy and ERCP. So these are constrained stents on a catheter that are passed right through the ERCP scope and are unconstrained to deploy, and you can get immediate decompression. You can see here many of these patients will have sludge and debris in their bile duct that nicely gets drained with procedure. Now, there are some patients that one stent is not enough. I've shown this case a few times over the years as a patient I took care of a few years ago that had a very complicated cholangiocarcinoma that kept getting recurrent cholangitis related to multifocal obstructions. And this patient, this is one of those examples where every patient is individualized. The kinds of stents you use, where you place them, how you place them is very different. And this is, a patient that did require 10 biliary stents to basically keep her out of the hospital, keep her from getting recurrent cholangitis. She lived about 2 years with recurrent stent changes. And it was quite a bear to do this, but she was quite grateful. And it's just an example of every patient is different. How do you manage their biliary tract obstruction? EUS, of course, is an important modality that's used alongside ERCP. This is just an example of a EUS-guided pancreatic biopsy. This is a patient that presented a couple years ago with hypoglycemia and recurrent seizures, and was found to have a suspected insulinoma, had negative CT and MRI, and was found on endoscopic ultrasound to have a 16-millimeter mass in the uncinate process of the pancreas. And you can see here the needle passing through the duodenal wall into the mass to get a diagnostic result. And, of course, we do this for other types of malignancies involving other parts of the pancreas, the bile duct, liver, et cetera, can be a very effective adjunct to ERCP. Anytime you talk about biliary obstruction, you have to mention percutaneous biliary drainage. This is definitely a component of treatment for some patients. This is when you transcutaneously, transhepatically drain the bile ducts. And nowadays is really indicated for patients in whom ERCP cannot be performed either due to anatomy, typically the Roux-en-Y gastric bypass patients, or in whom their biliary obstruction has been incompletely or inadequately been decompressed by the ERCP. And nowadays that's typically in the setting of multifocal obstruction, patients that have both right and left-sided obstruction that you're not able to completely drain. Endoscopically, here's an example of a patient that has an endoscopic left-sided biliary stent and then has two right-sided percutaneous drains. So this is definitely an option, and we certainly work closely with radiology to manage these patients, but we also recognize that for patients, when you ask them and talk to them about their experience, these are very painful for them. It can be extremely debilitating. Quality of life can be very difficult for these patients, and they can, of course, lose considerable fluids if it's externally drained. So our goal is to use this as a bridge to a more definitive internal biliary drainage procedure. Our learning points are here. Multiple causes of hyperbilirubinemia. Biliary obstruction is a defined clinical entity, multiple different causes. Of course, good history, physical, labs, and imaging can usually identify the site and the cause of obstruction. Early implementation of antibiotics can help you avoid the patients spiraling down into sepsis and Raynaud's pentad. And endoscopic evaluation has become really the premier modality for definitive treatment in most of these cases and for biliary drainage. Thanks for your attention.